Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Welcome to Rails with Jason. I'm here today with my guest, Adam McCray, creator of Rails Autoscale. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Adam, do you want to tell us about yourself, who you are?
Sure. I'm a Rails developer. I've been doing Rails full-time since 2007. Did many years of consulting, then many years of working for a few different product companies. Most recently, I work for a company called You Need a Budget, also called YNAB. I work on their web app, which is Rails with an Ember.js front end. And as you mentioned, I also created Rails Autoscale, which is a Heroku add-on for acting basically as a safety net for your Rails application on Heroku. It'll scale you up when you need it and down when you don't. And that's a product that I started back in 2016, and it's still working on it as a side project.
Okay. I have a lot of questions about a lot of that stuff. You said 2007. That's pretty early. How did you find Rails in 2007 or whenever you found it?
I think back in those days, I'm trying to remember which came first. I mean, I know I've been a huge fan of, 37 Signals, which is now Basecamp, for a long time. And I think I was following, their Signal versus Noise blog maybe before Rails or maybe after. It's so hard to keep track of the timeline after all these years. At the time, I was in corporate IT. I was doing classic ASP and Visual Basic. Basically just desperate for a better way to do things. And So as soon as I heard about this Rails thing and I grabbed, the original Agile Web Development with Rails book, I just started reading about it and I just fell in love. Like this is the way I want to build software.
Yeah. Yeah. I did ASP Classic too before I came to Rails. It wasn't the only thing I did before Rails, or even the main thing I did before Rails, but man, I don't know about you, but I found it to be just awful.
it was awful, but at the same time, it was the only thing that I knew. I mean, that was, my first experience with web development was, classic ASP and Visual Basic. So I thought, well, I guess this is just the way you do things. I'd never heard of a unit test. I'd never heard, even the concept of a framework was surprising to me when Rails came along.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's easy to forget how, at one point, you didn't know about that stuff. And, it sounds like you've been coding for maybe, a similar amount of time to me. So you remember, the early 2000s, people weren't really using frameworks. That wasn't a big thing, at least not something that I was really aware of.
Yeah. I mean, I think in the Java world, they started using things like struts and things like that. And actually, at the time that I, left corporate IT and went and worked for a small consulting shop doing Rails, I was sort of in the transition. If I had stayed where I was going to be learning Java and doing struts and EJBs and all this stuff, which was kind of frameworky, I guess. I don't know. I was just kind of thrilled to get out of there and not really have to learn that stuff because I didn't want to.
Yeah, going back to the ASP thing, let's see. I don't even remember the sequence of what I did. There was some Perl, there was some ASP Classic early on, some Java. And it was kind of like you said, it was the only thing I knew, so I didn't know how bad it was. And then I went from ASP to PHP, and I found PHP to be better than ASP because I just like the whole LAMP stack with Linux. I like that a lot better than Windows and Internet Information Server and all that stuff. So that was an improvement. And it's like, I didn't know how bad ASP was, but when I started using PHP, I was like, whoa, actually that stuff before, that really sucked. But then I didn't know how bad PHP was. It was just kind of like, it seemed like this is what there is. And then I switched to Rails, and I was like, whoa, now I realize that PHP is terrible. And by the way, that thing just happened that I hate so much. I hate it when I'm listening to a podcast and it does the mail ding thing, and I just did that. So I apologize, dear listener. I just closed my mail program. I'm very sorry.
I didn't hear the mail ding on my side, so maybe the listeners didn't hear it either.
Oh, well, I either subjected them to the mail ding or I subjected them to my complaint about the mail ding without the mail ding itself.
Either way, I'm not sure which is worse.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so let's get back to your story. You found Ruby and Rails and all that stuff, and you've been sticking with that since back then, it sounds like. Is that right?
Oh yeah, I love Rails. I think it's still one of the best tools for building web apps. And yeah, any new web app that I'm working on, I mean, Rails is going to be the default choice for me unless I have a compelling reason to choose something else.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, and like obviously only like be open to the extent that you're comfortable or you think your employer would be comfortable or whatever, but can you tell me anything about like how you do coding at You Need a Budget? Like maybe you could just give a feel for like what's the team like, what's your development process, that kind of thing, again, just to the extent you're comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've only been there 3 months, and in a way I feel like I'm still just figuring things out. But the general process is, I know Basecamp has been talking a lot about their shape up process, which is like 6 week cycles. And our process is similar in that we also work in 6 week cycles and these small cross-functional teams.
Wait, sorry, can you tell us about that shape up thing? Because yeah. I've kind of peripherally seen that. I haven't really paid attention, so I don't really know.
Yeah, so like last fall, I don't remember exactly when, Basecamp published a book called Shape Up, which is all about their product development process and sort of how they work in 6 week cycles, how they prior to starting a cycle, they've shaped the work so that it's defined enough so that the implementation team knows what they're building, but flexible enough so that the implementation team has variable scope to flex it as it needs to fit in that 6 weeks. But the idea is that something's shipping in that 6 weeks, and if it
fixed
doesn't,
time,
it's not
flexible scope.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the idea. Yeah, and the book is amazing. I loved it. And matter of fact, I just got lucky that I read the book. I was kind of loving this idea of a shape up process at the same time that I was interviewing with YNAB. And then, and when they told me like, yeah, we work in these 6 week cycles, I was like, yes, I'm interested.
Yeah. Okay. So what about this 6 week cycle interests you? I'm used to working in like 1 or 2 week cycles. That seems good to me. 6 weeks seems pretty long. What do you like about that approach?
I like that it's long enough to get something substantial done. You know, I feel like, I've worked in the whole 1 or 2 week cycles before, or sprints or whatever the organization's going to call them. And what tends to happen is you don't really get anything substantial done in that time. So one feature or one project, it's going to go through many of those cycles or of those sprints or whatever. And what often happens is it just gets automatically extended until it ends, which is maybe yeah. months away, maybe who knows how long. The idea with 6 weeks is that it's long enough to get something substantial done, but short enough that you can feel the end of it. You can kind of see how much time you've got left, and you, as a small implementation team, can make the trade-offs necessary to get something shipped in that 6 weeks.
Yeah,
and the idea is at the end of the 6 weeks, it doesn't just continue if you didn't get it done. Like that cycle's over, And maybe you'll get another opportunity to dive back into that thing, but maybe not. It does not get automatically extended.
That would take some discipline.
It does. It does. But I think the fact that you have 6 weeks, it's enough time to, you know, early on in the cycle, you address, you know, what are the high risk areas? Where are you not quite sure about? You know, Basecamp talks about how it's going uphill and going downhill. At the beginning of the cycle, you're going uphill. You're figuring things out. There's a lot of unknowns. And at some point, you're going to be close to the top of the hill where it's like, okay, we know what we need to do now. We've kind of figured out the risks. And now let's just make it happen. And from there, it's more downhill and you have a lot more confidence.
It seems to me, and tell me if you think otherwise, it seems to me like working in this style probably requires you to be working in a team that's composed of grown-ups who can, like, again, have that level of discipline and planning and all that kind of stuff in order to make something happen in that 6 weeks. Because if you get the 6 weeks and then it's over and it's just over and you don't, like, oh, well, let's just make it 7 weeks, just this one time, we'll just make it 7 weeks. If you're not going to do that, then you have to be, like, really serious with your planning. And quite frankly, a lot of the developers I've worked with in the past, they probably wouldn't be successful in that kind of working style, because here's my experience a lot of the time. We'll work in 2 week sprints and we will have, okay, so like, I'm not putting the blame on like one developer or anything like that, because a lot of times it's like a relatively inexperienced PM, a team full of relatively inexperienced developers, kind of everybody's relatively inexperienced or relatively undisciplined or whatever. And so what will happen is we'll start off with stories that are nebulously defined. It's just like one line that says like implement dashboard. And it's like, okay. And you know, it's both fuzzily defined and it's kind of big. Like this dashboard thing, that might be like a 2 week project. And so it's like, okay, we put this two week story into this 2 week sprint. That's a pretty tight squeeze. And like any story I think that's longer than like 1 or 2 days is a pretty big story. So we'll have that kind of a situation. The developer will set to work on this nebulously defined story. They'll get kind of partway done by the end of the sprint. Nobody really knows. It just kind of gets kicked to the next sprint. And eventually, a super long time later, way longer than anybody expected and way longer than anybody would have liked, it finally gets merged in and deployed.
Yeah, that's the way most development works.
Oh, it's pretty sad. And so, you know, that's just the like, this isn't very nice of me to say, but just it's the truth is because most, well, there's Conway's law, you know, not Conway's law. What is it? Sturgeon's law? It's some law. 90% of everything is crap. Have you ever heard that?
No.
I was commenting to my friend many years ago. I'm like, you know what? Most metal sucks. He's like, well, yeah, but like most music sucks. Most stuff sucks. And it's totally true. And that applies to developers too. Like most developers are not that good. And I feel bad saying it, but it really is true. And so I think that style of working in the 6 week cycles probably wouldn't work at your average organization, I think. What do you think?
I guess I'm skeptical too. I've been really lucky to have worked on some amazing teams that I think could pull it off. In a typical like corporate IT setting, it'd be tough. But I think as you move beyond that and you go into some smaller companies, where you've got a group of people who really care about the product that they're working on, and they're not just, you know, clocking time. Yeah, I don't know. I've worked with a lot of great people, and I think it probably can work with more people than we might give credit for. Because, like you said, a lot of projects are just set up for failure in the sense that you might have an entire team of inexperienced people. Like, you don't have somebody experienced on the team to sort of be a leader and a mentor on that team. You might be handed a story with vague requirements, you know, build a dashboard. Well, I could build a dashboard in 30 minutes. It's not going to be very useful. It's going to be really ugly, but I could do it. Or we could spend 30 weeks on it and it could have all the bells and whistles, but you have to understand, obviously, to build a dashboard, you need a whole lot more context than that. You need to know who it's going to serve, you know, what need drove the desire to have a dashboard and all those things. So I think, you know, whether you're talking 2 weeks, 6 weeks, inexperienced devs or whatever, you've got to set a team up for success by clearly defining what's the need that's driving a particular request, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. This is a little different of a topic, but sometimes I take issue with the advice that comes from 37 Signals or Basecamp. I'm still calling them 37 Signals, even though they've been called Basecamp since like 2012 or whatever. Sometimes I take issue with their advice because they are such outliers. Like, they achieved this huge outsized success at a relatively young age. And like, they have DHH and they have Jason Fried. And sometimes I feel like succumb. That's the word. They succumb to this way of thinking that a lot of people do, where they like have a single large success and they make a generalization from that single large success and say, oh, we did this and we were successful from that. That must mean that this is the way to do things if you want to be successful. That's not to say that everything they say is wrong or anything even close to that. But I take everything they say with a grain of salt, because it's like, okay, that works for you guys, but you guys are like geniuses, and like, I'm not as smart as you guys, and neither are most other people. So I'm a little skeptical of a lot of their advice.
I think it's good to take every piece of advice with a grain of salt. And I think there's some truth to the fact that, you know, they've built several products over the years, and they got rid of most of them, and they've settled on Basecamp, which is the product that they started with. But over that time, what they have been able to repeat is their process. And that's why I do think there's a lot of value in them sharing their shape up process, because that's not something that they just did once and it works. That's something that they're doing over and over again, that it
works. When you say their process, you mean their like creative process of building their products?
I don't know if it's the creative process, but the actual mechanics of their product workflow, you know, how they work in cycles, how they break up into teams, and how they divide the work and that kind of thing. I think that is very useful to share. And like you said, still take it with a grain of salt. But ultimately, I have tremendous respect for, you know, for David and Jason and all them, but they're not geniuses. They're just people. And
I DHH, he's like a fucking genius.
He's like, very good. He's very good and he's very smart. But I think we got to be careful not to put people on too high of pedestals. Because, I mean, he's just a person. You know,
and really super smart person.
Like, that is true.
So working for Jason Fried was like, unless I'm mistaken, it was like his first job, and it was one of the first things he built. And out of that, he extracted Rails, and it's become like this world changing, you know, in the scope of programming, this world changing framework. Like, that's pretty crazy. Obviously, there's probably some combination of luck there, but like, I wasn't creating a framework for my first job that I ever got hired for. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, he's an outlier for sure, and what he's done is incredible.
Yeah. But maybe you're right that maybe genius is too strong of a word, but maybe it's not. Okay, so let's see. We were talking about I'm just trying to think because I always go down rabbit holes when I'm talking to people on this show. Okay, I'm just going to share an unrelated thought, even though it's not that relevant. And this is no longer me like trying to make this conversation educational or anything. I'm just gonna rant for a second. The business advice from 37 Signals of scratch your own itch. I find that to be a really interesting thing. And this is kind of going back to like taking their advice with a grain of salt, because that's something that worked for them. They built project management software. Because they needed project management software. And like, it's actually, I don't know, it could be really good advice. It could be really terrible advice. I think it's maybe advice that just maybe needs more context, because you could scratch your own itch and be very successful with that. And you can scratch your own itch and build like the world's 100 millionth bug tracker software and not have anything come out of that. I don't know. That's not very productive. That was just a little rant of mine. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about Rails Autoscale. And I'm reminded of this because I was talking about scratching your own itch, and I have a hunch. I don't know anything about Rails Autoscale yet or how you came up with it or anything like that, but maybe that was a scratch your own itch kind of thing. But can you tell me where this idea came from and all that kind of stuff?
It was absolutely a scratch your own itch kind of thing. So the product that I was working on at the time, this was 2016, we were moving our hosting from Engine Yard to Heroku, for many reasons. One is just the simplicity and the constraints that Heroku provides. You know, we wanted to spend less time doing ops on Engine Yard, and we were also spending just a ton of money. And we believed we could save a lot of money by moving to Heroku. So we moved to Heroku and went great. The issue we were having was this was an internal app primarily used during business hours, Monday through Friday. And during that time, we needed a lot of capacity to handle all the traffic. And the app was kind of slow, so we needed additional capacity for that too. Then on night and on the weekends, we needed very little capacity, and we didn't want to pay for computing power that we weren't using. So quick sort of overview of how Heroku works. You pay for things called dynos, which are just Heroku's notion of containers. So you might up for a really small app, you might be able to host it on a single dyno. But as your app grows in traffic, or if your app is slow, you're going to need multiple dynos. You're
Sorry, just
scaling
quick
out
question.
horizontally. Yeah.
Is a dyno kind of equivalent to like an EC2 instance?
It would be more equivalent to. So I'm honestly like not much of an ops guy, so it's hard for me to draw analogies to other things. I mean, it would be more analogous to maybe a VM or a container within an EC2 instance.
Okay.
But the idea is you could have many dynos running, and so they're all just containers that are running, you know, like Puma, your Rails server, and Heroku is taking in requests and basically acting as a load balancer, sending those requests. Spreading those requests amongst your dynos that you have running. And you choose how many dynos you run, and you pay, you know, it's, you know, for the base level dyno, it's $25 a month. And you can dial them up and down through their web UI or through their command line interface. And it's very easy to change, but it's also very manual if you're not automating it. And at the, you know, by default, nothing's automated for you. So you need to figure out how many dynos you need to run. You need to tweak them up and down as necessary. there were some auto scaling solutions at the time that we tried. And the problem was they were all scaling based on application response time. And like I said, our app was actually pretty slow. It had some particularly slow endpoints that we hadn't been able to optimize yet. And that was sort of giving us a lot of unpredictable behavior with the auto-scaling solutions that we tried. It would assume that we needed to scale up because of our slow requests, even though maybe we weren't having much traffic at that time at all. So my thought at the time was I wanted to do a quick experiment to see if I could build an auto-scaling solution based on request queue time, which is basically the time that a request sits waiting to be processed by your Rails application. So in a sense, a request comes in, Heroku sends it to a dyno, and it's going to sit there, at least in Puma's case, at the socket level in Puma, waiting for one of the Puma workers to become available to pick it up and grab it. And even if your app is slow, if you don't have much traffic and you have the capacity, that queue time is going to be very short because a request is going to come in, Puma's going to pick it up right away and work on it. If you have a capacity issue, meaning all of your Puma workers are busy, requests are going to sit there and they're going to queue up. And that's what request queue time just means, the time that it's spent sitting in that queue state. So basically, I wanted to build an experiment that autoscaled based on that queue time. And that was the origin of Rails Autoscale, is I built it as a quick experiment for us internally. You know, I built it on my own time with the idea that this might be a product idea. But the initial version of it, you know, was obviously, it was duct tape and bubble gum, just something working, but it worked really well for us. And that was 2016. And toward the end of 2016 was when I started building it so that it would work for other apps, not just ours, and integrating it into the Heroku add-on marketplace. And then in 2017, I launched the beta of it in the marketplace.
Okay. If we can unpack some of that, how did you approach your employer? And was it like an employer-employee situation, or you're contracting for them? And how did you approach them and say like, hey, I built this thing, do you want to use it? Or like, how did all that stuff go?
Yeah, I was an employee and it was a really small company. We were, I was employee 20. And I think at the time we were maybe 30 people. And our software team was three of us. So it was basically just three of us. And I approached my boss and basically said, hey, I'm going to build this thing. If I build it in my own time, do you care if we try it on our app? And he was like, yeah, no problem. It was very casual. Like I've always strived to have really just really strong relationships with the folks that I work for, so that I tend not to worry too much about the risk and ramifications of things like this, probably to a fault, but it hasn't bitten me yet. So there was nothing written down. I just asked, hey, I'm going to try this thing. They were like, okay, cool. So I built it, and there was never any question about who owned it. It was clear from the beginning that it was just a thing that I was working on my own time. It worked out well.
And then how did you, okay, actually before I ask that, when they started using this product, how, from a technical perspective, how like ready did it feel? Like, were you able to plug it in and it kind of worked and that's that? Or was there like, okay, I'll ask it this way. I built a product one time, and like when I got my first customer using it, there was like a mad scramble on my end just to get it up to like the minimum level that it needed to be, just to like be almost satisfactory, you know? So was it like that, or was it more the other way where it was like, okay, from the beginning?
Well, keep in mind that, so the first customer was me, right? So like I built the service, but I'm also the one who's trying to use the service. So, you know, I kind of had the flexibility for it to be really clunky. And it was long enough ago that I don't remember the specifics, but I'm sure it didn't work right away. You know, I'm sure that like I probably plugged it in and it was just all over the place, completely like unreliable. But as long as it didn't bring our app down, it, you know, that's fine. Like the, which I don't think that it ever did. But me being the first customer, it really allowed me to take my time, you know, tweaking how the autoscale algorithm worked and all that without even worrying at all about like the UI, because I was the only one using the UI. So it could look really bad.
Yeah. You had the world's most forgiving customer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And before this, were you like seeking out a product idea, or was that something that was not even on your radar and you're just like, that's when you started going down that kind of path, or where was your mind in that sense?
My mind has always been thinking of product ideas, and, you know, had several false starts with various, you know, various product ideas that never went anywhere. This was the first thing that I ever actually launched to real production usage, even though I'd started several projects in the past, but they always fizzled. And I think the reason they always fizzled is because I didn't have that first customer. That was, I think, the thing that made this product sticky for me, is as soon as I launched it and we were actually using it, like, we weren't just using it as a toy. We were using it in production. Like, I wasn't getting money for it, but I had a production user that I didn't want to let down.
Yeah. And I bet it was like, it was useful to the degree where if you like took that product out and you said, hey, actually, we're not going to use this anymore, like, it probably would have been negatively impactful, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we were saving a ton of money because, you know, prior to us having this autoscaler, we had to have our app basically cranked up to, I think it was 8 dynos all the time. So, you know, 8 times 25, that's $200 a month that we were paying that we didn't necessarily need to be paying. As soon as we got the autoscaling in place, like at night and on the weekends, we went down to a single dyno because we didn't need it hardly at all. So immediately we were, you know, saving upwards of, you know, $100 a month or more, which doesn't seem like a lot, but to a real business, it doesn't seem like a lot. But for a product that costs a fraction of that, and in fact, at the time they weren't paying for it at all, it was a tremendous amount of value. And just the safety net aspect of it, that if, you know, as if we do have a capacity issue, it's going to scale up and we don't have to worry about just completely crashing on our users.
Yeah. So customer number one is typically very difficult. It's either like the hardest one or the easiest one, you know, depending on the scenario. In this scenario, it sounds like maybe the first customer was a scenario where it's relatively easy because like that's where the whole thing came from. How did you get customer number two? That seems like the really hard one in this scenario.
Yeah. So from there, when you're building a Heroku add-on, you go through a few different phases. You start out in the alpha phase, which means you're not listed in the Heroku marketplace, but you can basically, if you have someone's email at Heroku login, you can let them install your add-on, and you have to find 10 customers, 10 people willing to install your add-on as an alpha add-on before you can go to beta. And so for that, I just reached out to my network. I'm like, hey, can anybody install this and give it a try and see how it goes? And I was able to do that just through my network, but ultimately none of those people actually had the need. None of those people actually used it. They just installed it because I asked them to. And that was helpful for me to get to the beta stage, which is when you're actually listed in the marketplace. You can't charge money yet. And you've got a little beta badge on your add-on in the marketplace, but you're at least listed. And that's when I started to get real customers, just because on Heroku, it's fairly common to search the marketplace for a solution when you have a problem. Oh, and that's how most of my users have actually found me. So go ahead.
Do you remember how long it was between the day you went beta and the day you had your first beta user?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't. I'm willing to say that it was probably a few weeks. It was not immediate.
Okay.
You know, even today, you know, it's growing slowly, but it's really only a handful of installations each week.
Okay, handful. That seems like a lot, though. That's like, for me, that would be enough activity to like make it feel like something's happening. There's something there. It's enough happening to motivate me to continue putting effort into it.
Yeah, that was extremely motivating to see people signing up on their own. And then I could peek in and actually see that they're actually using it and that it's actually scaling their apps. And I was like, wow, people I've never met are actually getting value out of this thing that I built.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite the feeling. I've experienced the same thing, maybe to a lesser degree or maybe not, through selling my books and stuff like that.
It's, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool feeling to see those emails come in that say such and such person just bought your product.
Yeah, on the flip side, one thing that I was really not prepared for that discouraged me was that, you know, all these folks who installed it, I emailed them all because I wanted to know, like, what do you think of it and how can I help? People don't respond to email is what I discovered. Oh. And this is not surprising, but my audience is developers. And as a developer, I know, like, we kind of just want to be left alone. Like, I don't want you to send me an email and see how I'm doing and stuff. I'm more forgiving of that now that I'm actually a product owner on the other side of the equation. But yeah, I sent a lot of emails and got nothing in return. And I'm used to it now. It doesn't sting like it used to. But at the time, I was just like, why won't anybody talk to me?
Yeah, you feel personally insulted.
Especially when, you know, if you're plugged into like the bootstrapping community at all, it's like, the advice you're always going to hear is you've got to talk to your customers. Talk to your customers. It's like, I'm trying. They don't talk to me.
Yeah. 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 It's a little bit painful, but it's totally true. Like, I signed up for a service just to see what it was. It was kind of like a competitive service to a product I was conceiving of at the time. And the founder or whatever sent me some emails and I'm like, yeah, I get what this guy's doing and like I feel a little bit bad, but delete. Like, because it's, you know, it's kind of hard actually. Like, somebody sends you an email and asks you how things are going and it's just like, I don't know what to say exactly. And like, you're busy, you got all this other stuff going on. So yeah, it's like, it's unfortunate that people don't respond, but it's also kind of understandable. But what kind of like response rate do you think you get percentage wise from these emails you send?
Maybe 1 in 30.
Okay.
Just like sort of like just that's just an off the cuff number, but
yeah.
it's low. But like you said, like I don't blame anybody for it. People are flooded with email, and especially these, you know, product emails. You know, you sign up for a new service, you know you're going to get the hey, thanks for signing up, how's it going, how can I help email, which it, you know, I've rewritten that email so many times to try to make it not seem like all the others, but everybody knows it's the same email they get from every other service they sign up for.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. It's like you see the email and the moment you recognized, like, You pattern match it for like, oh, this is one of those welcome emails. I can just delete this.
That's so true. Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit unfortunate if you're the person trying to get a response from your welcome email, but that's the way it kind of works, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. So you built this in 2016. I think you said it went beta in 2017. Is that right?
Right.
Now, is this something that you're imagining will go like, you know, it'll grow to where it replaces your job income and then you do just that? Or like, will this be a side thing for the foreseeable future? How do you look at all that stuff?
I would love for it to grow to the point where I could rely on it as my sole income if I needed to. I'm a little conflicted on if I would want to keep it as a side project or not, because I actually, like, I love my day job. And as of now, I want to keep it as long as I can, but I also want more time to work on Rails Autoscale. So it's really hard to say what the future holds. Right now, I'm just trying to keep it growing slowly and see where it ends up.
Yeah. Yeah. And your website looks really good when I was looking at it, which is, you know, it's not often that a good designer and a good developer are found in the same person. Did you design this yourself? And by the way, I'm looking at railsautoscale.com if anybody's interested to look at what I'm talking about. Did you design this yourself, or is this like some kind of template, or how did you do this?
Yeah, I designed it myself. So thank you for the kind words. I definitely don't think of myself as a designer.
Well, it looks good. How did you, if we can just get into the details for a second, how did you like come up with the colors and stuff like that? Because that's one difficult thing, is like finding colors that look good together.
So the logo and the color, that I did not do myself. I did hire a friend of mine to help me with that. Yeah, my colors were initially, purple was initially my brand color, until I kind of realized, people thought that I worked for Heroku. People thought that this was actually part of Heroku, because Heroku's brand color is purple. So I wanted to move away from purple to make it clear that this is an add-on for Heroku, but it's not part of Heroku's brand. Yeah, and beyond that, my friend who was a designer who I was working with on the logo and the colors, I mean, you know, she asked me a bunch of questions in terms of like, how, you know, what kind of feeling do I want the app to convey and stuff like this. And so she presented me with a bunch of options and stuff like that. And that's where we landed. I knew that I either wanted green or red. I debated red to really sort of embrace the Rails aspect of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Ultimately, I don't think the stuff matters that much. I went with green because green's my favorite color, is really what it boils down to.
Yeah. Well, that's a little interesting piece of personal trivia. Adam's favorite color is green. I'm glad that I know that now. My favorite color is blue, in case anyone listening is curious. Okay. So we're kind of nearing the end of the hour. And my last question will be, where can people find you online and all that kind of stuff? But I want to ask you at least one or two questions before we get to that final question. And here's my question, and I'm going to totally put you on the spot, and you can take a second to think before you answer if you want to. I think you're maybe kind of similar age to me, and you've been programming for about as long as me, at least like a couple of decades or whatever. So here's my question. What advice would you have for somebody getting into Rails today or getting into programming today? If you could impart just one or two pieces of advice to that person, what would that be?
That is tough because it's been so long.
You know what? Let me ask a more specific question. And this might require a little bit of setup, but something I've been thinking about a lot lately is how I structure my code in my Rails projects. I used to just put everything into Active Record classes, and I would end up with these big like 500 line Active Record models. If there was a user class, then everything tangentially related to a user would end up in there. There'd be all kinds of mixed levels of abstraction in there. It would be just a total mess. As I've advanced in my career, I've learned different ways of organizing my code. Now I like to take out some of those things. Like, for example, if we keep going with this user model example, if I see that there's like four or five methods that are kind of related to each other but not related to the other methods so much, I'll look at those and say, maybe there's like a concept that this represents. It's not a concept that has a name yet, but if I look at it and think of it, I can kind of think of a name, pull that out into another class, and that's one way that I like to use. Sometimes in different situations, I use concerns, and so now I don't end up with these big, long active record models anymore. So instead of asking that really broad question, which I appreciate is a hard question to answer on the spot, how do you organize your Rails code? Do you like to use concerns? Do you like to use poros, some other way? How do you do that?
A combination of each. I think, honestly, ultimately, I don't think it matters that much. I think that's, after working on just so many different code bases over the years, I've seen everything written so many different ways, and ultimately, it just doesn't matter that much. What matters is that someone new could step into that code base and find their way around. And I think concerns are a good way to do that, and I think poros are a good way to do that, as long as, especially in a framework like Rails, you're still embracing the Rails conventions. I think there was a time a few years back, and I don't know if it's still sort of happening, but it felt like there was this wave of just pulling everything out of, get everything out of your models, everything out of your controllers. We're going to build all these different sort of object structures and everything. And it's like, if that's really how you want to build your apps, that's fine. But why are you using Rails? Like, the whole philosophy of Rails was convention over configuration and making these little decisions for you so that you don't have to overthink all these little things. So over the years, I'm a huge proponent of embracing Rails conventions, and the more vanilla Rails, the better. It makes it so that somebody new can step in, and somebody new who knows the Rails conventions can follow and figure out how things are going. So that means concerns are great, because that's a Rails convention. Poros are not anti-Rails convention, as long as you've got an active record model, but it's calling out to a poro. That's totally fine.
And by the way, if the listener doesn't know what we mean by poro, that's plain old Ruby object, P-O-R-O.
Yeah. I think those are great approaches. I'm happier working in a code base that has smaller files. It can be a bit mind melting to have to navigate through a 1,000-line user class, but we've all been there. And when you have to, you make it work. And at the end of the day, you can probably still get done what you need to.
All right, I'm going to push you a little bit on that one. If, let's say, somebody came to you and they said, Adam, I have this like 1,500-line model file. I'm a pretty new programmer. I don't know where to start with refactoring this into something nicer. Can you give me just like one approach I could use to start refactoring this into something more easily understandable?
Oh, that is a good question. So I guess the first thing that I would ask is, do you have tests? Because that's the first thing you need if you want to refactor anything, I think.
And why?
At least for me, again, it's take every bit of advice with a grain of salt. This is what works for me. For me, if I'm refactoring without tests, I don't actually know if my refactoring is working or not. So I want the tests to give me the confidence that, if I have tests in place and I remove a piece of code, well, that test should break. Okay, but I can add that code back and refactor it. And once that test is green again, I'll know, okay, my refactoring got things back to where they were. And so I can have some confidence in the refactoring.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, I think some things are objectively better than other things. Like if you talk about concerns versus poros, for example, like you could make arguments either direction for that. Like I tend to use concerns in certain scenarios, but if somebody did that a different way, I wouldn't necessarily say my way is better. But like testing versus not testing, I think testing is objectively better than not testing, because like if you refactor a piece of code and you don't have any tests, like you said, you have no way of knowing if you're breaking existing functionality. So I wouldn't say that like that works for me and that's what I like. No, that's just better. That's what fair. I'm saying, at least.
No. I think I agree with you there. But that's just like the tip of the iceberg, right? Then you get underneath that. It's like, okay, what are we talking about? Unit tests? Are we talking about high level functional tests? And that's where you get into the, big debate and anymore. I opt out of those debates. I'm like, hey, if you like to go down to the unit level and mock everything, like that's your bag. That's fine.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. There are a lot of different ways to test and it's not always clear what's better and what's not. It is better to test than to not test, but yeah, once you get into those details, you could have a lot of really long religious debates about a lot of that stuff.
Yes, I've been in many of those.
All right, well, Adam, I think that's a good piece of advice and maybe a good place to wrap that up. If you want to refactor a piece of code, the place to start is add some tests to it. Not to toot my own horn or plug my own stuff or whatever, but I wrote some blog posts about like if you have a piece of legacy code and you want to start adding tests to it, because that's actually a pretty tricky thing. If you just Google like Jason Sweat legacy code, I think you can find it. Okay, let me ask you now my last question that I always ask every guest, which is where can people find you online and where can they find out more about Rails Autoscale?
Find me on Twitter. It's Adam Logic, and find Rails Autoscale at railsautoscale.com.
Awesome. Well, Adam, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jason. This was great.